This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor Peter Coyote is best known for his roles in E.T., Jagged Edge, and Outrageous Fortune. He didn't start acting in films until his late 30s. Until then, the theater he participated in was radical street theater. Coyote was a member of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, and he was a digger. The diggers were one of the most celebrated collectives of the 60s. They ran a free store and handed out free food daily in Golden Gate Park. Coyote says this period continues to be trivialized and misunderstood, so he's writing his own memoir of the times. And he just wrote an introduction to a new edition of Ringolivio, a memoir by the late Emmett Grogan of the Diggers. Ringolivio is part of a new series of books called Citadel Underground, which is bringing some of the classic works of the 60s counterculture back into print. Part of the distorted view of the 60s can be attributed to Peter Coyote's current employer, Hollywood. Coyote will be the first to tell you, films about that time just never seemed to get it right. He almost directed a sequence in one of the classic 60s films, Easy Rider, but the negotiations with Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda fell through at the last minute.
These guys assumed that we were all kind of flower children or something. So when Peter and Dennis offered me $20 a week and to sleep on their couch to do this film, we passed, and I had hoped to put a bunch of really hungry actors to work. And so they put a sequence in Easy Rider of a guerrilla theater troupe, spelled G-O-R-I-L-L-A, bunch of old hookers and people of dubious sexual persuasion mincing around in tights, which I took great affront to. And that film in particular seemed to suggest that if you lived the way that my friends and I were living, you were going to get killed by some redneck in the South. And aside from the splendor of getting Jack Nicholson in that film, everything else about it was totally wrong. And that just seems to be the way, you know, when you bring a lot of money in and when you try to do an artistic restatement of something, the multiplicity of life gets squeezed down to a single point of view, well, and something gets cockeyed in it.
This idea of offering you $20 a week and a couch to sleep on, do you think that people thought just because you had run free stores and given away free food that you'd be perfectly happy to work for free?
I think so. Or, you know, I mean, it took a lot of money and a lot of energy to live free. I have to point that out. And the diggers were pretty mysterious about how and where we got that money. And we did that for a reason. And usually we would give away any money that was given to us in front of the people who gave it to us.
Peter Coyote is my guest. In your introduction to Ringolivio, you describe yourself and the people who you were with during the 60s as life actors. Now, as someone who is a professional actor now, what do you mean by life actor?
Well, it occurred to a number of us one day that we were writing these plays to excoriate the politics of the middle class, and they were giving us medals. We had won an Obie in New York in 1967, and it occurred to us that theater was not going to be a vehicle for radical change, because when you paid admission at the door, you knew in your deepest bone marrow that it was a business. And if you didn't like the conclusions or the point of view that was put forward on the stage, it was like going into a store where you didn't like the merchandise. You just left. Nothing really challenged the question of storeness. Should there be a store at all? So we thought, what would happen if we would take our same aesthetic impulses and imagination and improvisatory abilities and play them out in real life and use situations as props to try to enlighten people to cultural alternatives that were not available, and to do it theatrically, but in a way in which no one could claim it was theater, where it was real life, and people had to come up and look at their responses in the same way that they would look at themselves in everyday life. So we tried to create situations where we and the other people involved were thrown in over their heads, where they were forced into new situations, like a free store. You go into a store, and not only are all the goods free, but so are the roles. So someone might come and ask for the manager, and the response would be, well, you're the manager, what shall we do today? And you keep playing around with them until they take it seriously, and at which point they become the manager, they get to try out their idea of what a free store might be, and everyone in the store will go along with it. So that would be an example of life acting.
It seems to me that the idea of life acting also covered your own identities. I mean, a lot of the people in the Diggers, I think, recreated themselves. You know, Emmick Grogan had been Eugene Grogan. You had been Peter Cohan, am I pronouncing that right? And I mean, you found new names for yourselves and, in a way, I think, new identities as well. Is that right?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, my relationship to my name was, I would say, more religious than political. But I definitely think it's true that when you grow up in a culture, your reality or your identity is circumscribed by that culture. There are certain options that are open to you. You know, Peter Cohan was this kind of a person, and he had these kind of expectations welded onto his identity. And at a certain point, if you want to break into new territory, you have to leave that identity behind. It's not necessary to do that or necessary to rename yourself, but it was something that was current then, and it seemed to function as a useful tool to give people the freedom to reinvestigate their choices and their decisions and their assumptions.
In the Diggers and in the San Francisco Mime Troupe, did you all know each other's original selves, or did you only know each other by your newer identities?
Well, things are not so clear-cut, are they? I mean, the fundamental insight of Buddhism is that there is no original self. There's nobody home. So on some level, you look at people as a constellation of actions and impulses and intentions and decisions. And so what we saw were these constellations in transition. You saw simultaneously the people we each wanted to be, the people we were, and the people we were struggling against. And that's what made it a particularly fascinating time and kind of what bonded us all so deeply, because nobody was purely anything. We were all trying to reinvent a culture and to come in contact with an idea of an untrammeled personal authenticity. And it was a difficult thing to do.
Was there a part of yourself that you felt, or your own background that you were struggling against?
You mean me personally?
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up with a lot of expectations about the right ways of doing things. For a period in my life, my family had a lot of money, and I knew that I was being deprived of true tests of my worth. I was being sheltered by this money and by certain kinds of privilege. And so that was something that I wanted to find out who I was and to test myself against the same standards that people without privilege faced. And that meant you had to go to some kind of free territory where your address or your name was meaningless. You couldn't live in the same town. If the cops stopped you and asked where you lived and you gave an address on Booth Avenue, you were going to be treated differently than a black kid who lived on 2nd Street. It was built into the system. So I think that's one reason why a lot of kids who were really serious about getting in touch with their authenticity fled to the free territories of the Lower East Side and Berkeley and Haight-Ashbury, because it was a place where you would be taken for who you were and how you behaved, and you would pay real dues.
Did you ever feel that if somebody found out about your background, that you had been from a privileged background, your father, I think, had been president of a railroad company and an oil company, that it would be a way of dismissing you? You know, like, well, sure, he's working at a free store, but he's from a privileged background.
No, I was never afraid of that. I had a problem. For instance, in the 60s, we had no money, and we lived in a very impoverished fashion. And yet my personal standards of excellence and elegance were groomed by the best museums and best art and access to a heightened spectrum of possibilities. And so I had a lot of ideas about elegance and excellence and standards that I had to sort through. How was I going to live without money and still manifest my idea of living up to certain standards of mind, not of wealth or value, but just standards of achievement or order of mind? How was I going to do that? So, for instance, I lived in this truck, but my truck was fastidious. You know, it was beautifully painted, and everything was repaired, and everything was stowed in little boxes and little tchotchkes and this and that. And a lot of people did that. And I was not a very good craftsman. Some of the gypsy truckers that I lived with were cabinet makers, and their trucks were works of art. They were impeccable.
One of the things that the diggers became really well known for was free stores, giving out free food. I remember I was living in Buffalo in 1969 and 1970, and there was a free store there, and I remember once it was ripped off. And it's like, what does it mean when a free store is ripped off? Did you ever go through a little kind of a crisis of confusion about that?
No, it was a crisis of humor. I thought it was fabulous coming to work in the free store one day, and there was a big, kind of large black woman who was furtively shoving clothes in a paper bag. And I went over equally furtively, and I kept watch, and I would shove things into the bag, and pretty soon we were in collusion, and we were jamming things into this paper bag, and she leaned over to me, and she said in kind of a throaty whisper, "Where's the boss?" And I said, "I'm the boss." And she looked at me stunned, and I said, "It's a free store." And she just stopped. She just didn't know what to do. I said, "It's a free store. It's yours." She said, "Everything?" I said, "My job." She said, "Your job?" I said, "Yeah." Then she said, "Get out of my face." So I just walked away. And she just blatantly went around the store and collected what she needed and left. So that was a piece of theater for her and for me.
When you were serving, say, free food at large gatherings, did you ever go through feeling, this is really great, but I don't really want to be preparing or serving food?
Yeah, so you'd stop. One of the great things about the diggers, I was never interested in the free food.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it just didn't interest me for a little while. But the diggers had no ideology. Everything was based on personal authenticity. And it was also kind of, we were kind of a reproach to the left. We felt that the left was always hiding behind ideology. We can't do this till after the revolution. Gee, if it wasn't for multinational corporations, we could such and such. And our attitude was, you know, do it. If you have an idea, do it. Create the condition you describe, as Peter Berg used to say. And so somebody thought, gee, all these kids are coming to San Francisco. The city's making a mint off tourists coming to the Haight-Ashbury. The merchants are trying to get rid of the kids. The city's trying to get rid of them. Somebody's got to feed them because they're here. So Emmett and a bunch of people wanted to do that, and they did it. Along the way, they turned it into a mechanism to create this idea of a free frame of reference, making people step through a huge yellow frame of 2x4s to get the food, and then giving them these little frames to wear around their necks to invite them to look at the world from a free frame of reference. But other people had completely different ideas. Somebody wanted to take a flatbed truck of black conga drummers and naked belly dancers down Montgomery Street at rush hour and invite the stockbrokers to get on board and change their lives. And they did that.
In your introduction to Emmett Grogan's book that's just been republished, Ringolivio, mm-hmm. you tell the story of how he shot you up once with heroin and mm-hmm. said, "This will really change you." Did he ask for your permission to do that? Did you want him to do that?
Yeah, I did. Seems insane, doesn't it? No, I wasn't tied down. I was a willing participant. You know, heroin, lots of people were into psychedelics, and there was an aspect of psychedelics that was turning out this kind of blissful, sexless, nirvana businessman, these kind of long-haired, hippie, merchant elite, you know, who really had no interests outside their own pocketbooks and appearing stylish. And heroin was there as, you know, the ally of Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday. And the line I used in the book was all of those people who had turned themselves into the flames that they signaled through. And it was just an option to try to find a new place in your consciousness that wasn't domesticated. Unfortunately, it was an option that didn't let you go so easily.
Well, how many times did you do it?
How many times did I do it?
Yeah. I mean, did you just shoot up once, or did you?
Oh, please, no.
Oh, no? Oh, okay. I wasn't sure.
Too much fun.
Oh, okay.
No, I wasn't sure. I did it until it was very hard to stop.
I see. Okay. Okay. Peter Coyote is my guest. And, you know, we were talking about how you had this, like, old and new identity. And I think they came together in a way when your father died, you went back with some of your friends from the Diggers. You went back to your mother's place to help her, I guess, recover from the death and also recover from the debt that your father had left her in. Was that an unusual experience to have the two worlds, the world of your family and the world of your friends, brought together for a while?
Boy, that was completely schizophrenic. I was never more out of my depth in my life. I went back and I was in this truck with wooden sides and a canvas cover. My mom was widowed. My dad had been a partnership, not a corporation. So everything was up for grabs, cattle ranches and homes and businesses. And it was millions of dollars in debt. And the creditors were literally pulling at her over the coffin. And the business had run through a huge land sale in about 10 days. And my mom was going to be on the street. And nobody was really helping her at all. So I walked into a barber shop one day and I cut my hair. All I could sit on it. The barber couldn't believe this. I cut my hair. I borrowed a suit from my mom, $150. I bought a suit. And we got all the creditors together. And basically I said, I've come back from the coast to be a rich and famous capitalist. And unless you absolve us of debt, interest on debt, which at that time was about $385,000 a year, I'm going to close the business and you'll get a nickel on the dollar. So they did that for a year. And I went into New York and I became a registered representative in 10 days. I became a stockbroker. And my father's salesman, of course, had stolen all his customers. And they gave me a book about 4 inches thick with the name of every company that employed two or more people in the state of New York. And I started making blind phone calls 8 hours a day. Hi, I'm calling from Morris Cohen and Company. We'd like to sell you the opportunity to desecrate Hawaii for $12 a share. And I did this. Then, because my daughter's mother at that time and my mother were not getting along, I moved up to the family farm, and she couldn't stay by herself, and so various friends from California came by, and we basically replicated one of our communes on the family farm. So Monday morning, I would get up, and I would go to Wall Street by bus, and I'd stay in the city till Thursday afternoon, and then I'd get off the bus, I'd change into my work clothes, and I'd do farm work, because our old neighbor had broken his back, and we were milking 60 of his cows and making hay and doing all this stuff for him for barter, you know, a ton of potatoes and 9 pigs. And so I would do manual labor Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then get back on the bus and go into New York. And I think that in the 10 months that I did that, I probably sold 2 stocks. And I had no idea what I was doing. I was never more out of my depth. And although I did manage to get my dad's insurance money from my mom, which she basically lives on today. She went out and got a job in her 60s, her first job in 40 years maybe. So it was a very, very surreal time. And, of course, my mother didn't understand these crazy people, and neither did all the people in this little town in Pennsylvania that I'd grown up in. All of a sudden, all these crazy people are around, you know, with long hair and funky trucks, and they're living in the outbuildings. And instead of being this showplace farm that was funded from all this Wall Street theft, it was turning into a large hippie artifact. And it was a very, very bizarre time.
Oh, boy, it sounds really crazy.
We ultimately lost the farm. We were all evicted, and that's all she wrote. It was 35 years of work on my dad's part.
Wow. Peter Coyote is my guest. How did you go from the life you were living to acting in Hollywood movies?
Well, I came back after we lost the farm. I came back to California. And at the same time, Gary Snyder, one of my old friends, won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. And the governor of California appointed him chairman of a new arts council, state arts council, he was going to form. And Gary asked me to join. And he said it would be an opportunity to define the state. I couldn't pass it up. And although we made a lot of mistakes initially, the next year I was elected chairman, And I was chairman for almost 3 years, and during that time raised the budget from $1 to $13 million annually. And to do that, had to make pretty broad political coalitions and had to co-opt a lot of right-wing legislators. And we gradually won their respect, and we made programs that were picked up and copied on the national level. And I was so good at it that I realized that I didn't really need to stay a prince in a kingdom of my own making, that I could talk to lots of different people. And I realized that I'd always had this secret yen to try the movies. I mean, if you're an actor, that is the big time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been prevented from doing that, really, by Digger ideology of anonymity and free. And so I was just winding up sticking needles in my arm. That didn't seem like a real healthy alternative. And so I decided to try it. So about 1978, I threw myself back into theater, and I worked 2 solid years at the Magic Theater. I did the world premiere of True West there, and 2 other premieres, one by Michael McClure called The Red Snake, another called Autobiography of a Pearl Diver by Martin Epstein, another one called Charles the Irrelevant, which was written for me. And I became kind of one of the hot young actors in San Francisco. And on the basis of that, I had a local agent, and she set me up for a number of meetings to go to L.A. And I met 16 casting directors. And I was about 38 by this time. I mean, I was too young to fool around, so I got pretty organized. And I kept a file card on each person I met. And if we talked about a book or a poem or a newspaper article, when I got home, I wrote them all a thank you note that was jotted on the card, and I sent the article. And then every month, I'd just write him a letter, a little note with my reviews or what I was doing. And after about 7 months of that, an agent called me out of the blue, a guy named Andy Friedman. And in September of 1990, this will be 10 years in the film business.
It's funny, don't you think, that many of the roles you're best known for are roles in which you've played, say, a government agent in E.T. or a district attorney in Jagged Edge, just exactly the kind of people who you haven't been.
Well, I think there's a kind of cultural bias that equates intelligence with malevolence. And I don't know why that is, but if the script says smart and evil, I'll get it. If the script says gorgeous and sexy, they'll send it to Kevin Costner. I don't know what it is. I think that it's that I have an ability to translate complex people. And to humanize some of these people that might otherwise be just stereotypes. And so I get called on to do that. The only problem with that is that unless you get the girl, you don't really get the power and the authority and the money. But I certainly am having a good time being an actor, and I can't complain because it's such an unstable occupation. There are so many people that would envy my problems.
Do you feel that you've become the person you wanted to be?
No, I think I'm still working on it. I haven't found the edges, you know, and I much prefer the surprise and the invisibility of constantly looking.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on Fresh Air.
Actor Peter Coyote. He has 3 films coming out in the next 6 months, including Crooked Hearts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.